Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Nice to have you listening in this morning. A stirring article about climate warming, old trees, and California caught our attention a couple of months ago. Written by the New York Times' John Branch, the story was accompanied by shocking photographs of blackened redwoods and withered sequoias taken by Max Whitaker in the wake of 2020's wildfires. The story said, this past summer in the Sierra Nevada, a fire ecologist named Kristen Shive camped in one of the few remaining ancient groves of giant sequoias among trees as old as the Bible. This fall, she revisited the grove and stood somberly among the dead. They've lived through literally hundreds of fires in their lifetimes. Now we're seeing them killed in one fell swoop. Minnesota and the upper Midwest don't have ancient sequoias, but we also have our share of majestic trees, and the warming world is changing the way they live, too. Today, in our continuing coverage of climate change, a focus on forests. America was once a land of vast forests, and the loss of them through fire and invasive species and continued residential encroachment not only changes the landscape, but it also changes our relationship to the natural world. So as our guests join us this morning, I'd welcome your questions about forests and the science of climate change. But you may also have had a singular hiking or camping experience in a forest. And if you can give me the condensed version of that experience, I would love to hear that. So welcoming questions about forests and the trees and the science of climate change. But I know many of us go into the woods to recharge, and maybe you've had a singular experience on a camping trip or a hiking trip, and you want to share that too. And I'd like to hear that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Char Miller is with us, a professor and director of environmental analysis at Pomona College, and with us from Claremont, California. Professor, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
We'll say no relation since we're both Millers, but good to have
you. That's true.
Molly Peterson is with us. She's a science reporter for KQED in Los Angeles. Molly, welcome to the show. It's good to have you on today.
Thank you. I also am no relation to you guys.
No Petersons, right? Professor Miller, here's what I'm curious about. Is the combination of the fire, the warming temperatures, the human deforestation, as I said, the kind of encroaching residential activity, is it presenting the kinds of challenges to our forests that perhaps they've never had to endure before? Is there something unusual about this moment?
Well, it is unusual, and a quick way for folks to understand that is that in August and September of 2020, five of the largest six fires that had, in recorded history at least, in California were burning at the exact same time.
Oh, my gosh.
Of which consumed more than 1 million acres. So that if that's not a smoke signal, I don't know what is. But I would say that in addition to residential encroachment into these fire zones, we need some longer term data. So, and the EPA has it. The Southwest, which includes California, has been drying out since 1980. It's projected to continue that trend through the rest of this century. And so there are climatic issues that are driving these fires. There are now 36, 37, 38 million people in California alone, many of whom live within these fire zones. So it isn't just that the fires are big. It's the fires are burning where people are living, or more to the point, people have moved to where the fire zones are located. And this is true all over the West. Since the 1990s, more than 36 million new households have been built in Colorado and Utah and Nevada and places like that in the fire zones.
Wow.
So we've done this number on ourselves.
Yeah, Molly, I'm really interested in your perspective on that, because I know you're out reporting when a big wildfire comes in and it threatens, you know, a residential community. People get an urgent, up close and personal look at what a threat these wildfires can be. Do you see that in your state changing human behavior and decision making at all yet?
I think so. I don't know that it's changing fast enough, but I'm based in Southern California. I've been reporting on fire on all kinds of landscapes in California for a long time. And I've been working for KQED in Northern California, where the fires we're concerned about are not only in the foothills of the Sierra Nevadas, but also in the kind of rural rolling areas north of the Bay Area, Sonoma County, Napa County, what people sometimes call the wine country fires or the North Bay fires. And seeing how people interact with that fire, understand how that fire is behaving differently than they've planned for, has really been kind of more transformative than anything else I've seen in the last 15 years.
Wow. Let me take some calls here to Melanie in Wayzata. Hi, Melanie. I'm really glad you called.
Hi, good morning.
Tell me a little bit about your relationship to the woods.
Yeah, we had some woods behind our house when I was really little. And I didn't have the best home life, so there was this cluster of oak trees in the woods directly behind my house, and that was, I played pretend back there for hours after school. I did, like, photo shoots with my little sisters where they dressed up as fairies. The woods was just kind of my safe haven. It was, I love that little spot in the woods.
Do you still get out into the woods, into the forests in our area?
Oh yeah, all the time. I have, I feel really drawn and connected to just the trees and Mother Nature. Like, that's where my sanity is.
Yeah,
is in the trees.
I hear that, right. It's a big part of the way we live here. And Professor Miller, I mean, that's why I suggested that, you know, all of these changes that you've described and that I was talking about in the introduction, this is not just kind of an academic exercise for us. I mean, it really has the potential to change our own relationship to the natural world. I wonder if you have some observation about what that might mean.
Well, I do. It totally changes the way we relate to the natural world, our perceptions of it, and our place within it. And I think part of what many of us are trying to figure out is not only how to keep people out of harm's way, but if you keep people out of harm's way and what they love is hiking in the San Gabriel Mountains or going up to the Boundary Waters or going out to the Cascades in the Pacific Northwest, and that very act is putting you in some kind of jeopardy, or the place that you want to go to, like the Sequoia, are not there any longer, we're going to have a very different kind of environmental aesthetic than we have cherished, nurtured, written about for 150 years or so. So this is to mix metaphors, this is a sea change.
Yeah. Molly, have you been up to that area where the sequoias and the redwoods were so damaged? I'd love your firsthand look if you've been there.
I mean, it's an interesting thing because fire, of course, we talk about fire as something that threatens us. When we talk about fire, we personify it. But that's not historically, before we started to suppress fire, the relationship that people had with fire on this landscape. So that said, the intensity of the fires, there's a reason these words exist, like ferocity of the fires now, are things that human neglect or human policy has contributed to. And so you do see a transformation of the ecosystem. So in a way that is not what traditionally would be expected. So there are such things as like fire following flowers, plants and flowers that sprout after a fire in a forest. And they are a beneficial effect to the forest. And but if it's so hot that the soil becomes waxy, those flowers do not sprout at the same. I'm using all these words that Charmiller can use much better, but these things don't happen at the same cycle that you would want to see in a beneficial fire cycle in California, which was once upon a time possible, and some people hope is possible again.
No, I really take your point on the way we think of fire as only destructive. And Professor Miller, maybe this is a good moment for you to follow what Molly is saying about fire can be extremely useful. But not,
it is,
yeah,
it
go ahead.
Be, and Molly's absolutely right, and her words are perfect. I think part of what we're seeing is a recognition, finally, that fire has a place in the landscape. At the moment, it is overwhelming the landscape, as Molly has pointed out. But if we go back to the 1760s, in the 18th century, when the Spanish missionaries are moving up through what they called Alta California, they were appalled by indigenous fire management, which produced all sorts of ecosystems that were intensely beneficial to them. And so fire suppression actually began with the Spanish missionaries, not just the U.S. Forest Service. But even then, with the Forest Service beginning in the late 19th century, the notion that you suppressed fire simply to grow trees, perfectly logical economic argument, made no sense ecologically, and it still doesn't. So part of what we're beginning to see in the Sierra, and has been true for maybe 10 years, are some very important, innovative reintroductions of fire, often led by the North Fork Mono and other tribes with the Forest Service and the like. We're starting to see ways by which that collaborative work can begin. It's not large enough to withstand, obviously, these big fires, but we have to start somewhere. And I think this past fire season has really ignited that conversation.
Let me go back to the phones here to Jim in St. Louis Park. Jim, good to hear that you have a degree in forestry. I'm glad you were listening this morning. What are you thinking about?
Well, fires are actually in Wisconsin and Minnesota, South Dakota, North Dakota are a lot less common now than they were pre-white settlement. Mm-hmm. And a lot of species in Minnesota are fire dependent, pines, especially jack pine, aspen, birch. And we're seeing northern Minnesota more sugar maple and basswood late succession trees because the fire isn't there. And I had heard one guy who people dismissed as kind of a nut saying in California that they should maybe graze land with goats to make fire breaks.
Okay.
And I thought that was an interesting concept.
I hear two really good points here, Jim. Professor Miller, first to you on the, we acknowledge how fire changes a landscape, but I think Jim is also asking, do you get other kind, as we've seen here in Minnesota, do you get other kinds of trees follow in when the original trees burn? Yeah.
Yes, we do. And it may not be trees. What we also may see is a land conversion from trees to shrub to grassland, which is happening all over the Southwest. Desertification, in effect. So we may get different. I mean, here's a way to think about it. Fires burn trees. They don't destroy forests. Forest will regrow. It just may be different species.
I see.
And I think that's part of what Jim is talking about.
Molly, he was also asking about reading something about goats coming in to clear out some of the underbrush and making these forests safer. Is that considered?
That is a solution that some places have used. Scaling up the amount of goats that would be necessary to help manage California's forests. So the state of California has something like 33 million acres of forest land.
Wow.
Last year, the fires that Char was talking about at the beginning burned close to 4.2 million acres or so. Figuring out a way out of this historic suppressing fires, which, you know, as Char pointed out, it came from Spanish settlers, there's an element of racism in attempting to like control land and manage land away from indigenous people in California. There's a lot of obstacles to reimagining how to live with wildfire in California. goats is not one of the obstacles. Goats is helpful, but the scale of what we need to do is landscape scale. So even where we are able to use fire as a helpful solution to worse fires, to out of control wildfires, this is called prescribed burning. When mm-hmm. you apply fire to the landscape in a controlled manner, you know, managing the forests a little bit differently with these controlled fires, with manual and machine-based kind of vegetative removal. And, you know, with goats, everyone's saying you need all of the above and more.
Yeah. I want to come back to the political will here, too, by state legislators, policymakers there. If you've just tuned into the conversation, Molly Peterson with us, a science reporter for KQED in Los Angeles, as we talk about what has happened with forests and wildfire in California, what we've also seen here in the upper Midwest in Minnesota, when a fire comes through, a big storm comes through and knocks down trees in the forest and then heightens the risk for wildfire. Char Miller is with us, a professor and director of environmental analysis at Pomona College. We're talking this morning about how our forest land across this country are being affected by the different changes that climate change is creating, you know, these infestations of beetles. Man, I've seen the evidence of this at Rocky Mountain National Park in Colorado. It's just kind of mind-boggling what that means for the forests that we love and our experience of those forests. I mean, this is a key part of, I think, who we are here in the upper Midwest. So tell me a bit about some of your questions about forest management, but also if you've had a singular experience in the forests here. Many of us have. I'd like to hear about that, too. If you can condense that a little bit, we can probably hear from more people. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Reach me on Twitter, at CarrieMPR, to Senthil in St. Louis Park. Senthil, thanks for waiting. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on, Carrie.
Sure.
My question is not directly related to forestry, but I recently came across some debate on whether growing crops actually sequesters or captures carbon from the atmosphere more than trees, and I wanted some clarity around that from your guests.
I am so glad you asked this question because we wanted to talk about carbon sequestration. So, Professor Miller, would there be some science to support Senthil's original question here?
That crops absorb?
Different kinds of crops, yes. Could be
Everything growing absorbs carbon. The question is really, as he pointed out, the quantity and the speed with which that happens. Soil absorbs carbon, and we're beginning to see really interesting experiments up in Northern California about how to think through that project of soil as a capturing mechanism. So all things absorb it. The larger question, I think, is you know, are we going to turn our forests into crops? And I hope not. And because we've seen that, for example, in the Amazon and other places where you simply convert huge swaths of forest to crop. And I think we lose a great deal when we do that. But I don't know the exact data to which he's referring.
Professor Miller, I want to talk a bit about how we are in this paradox of needing to preserve and increase our forests to buffer against the carbon, that is coming along with the greenhouse gas emissions and the warming world. And yet I see this study out of the University of Zurich in 2019 that says 2.5 billion acres of additional forest could store 200 gigatons of carbon, and we are going in the opposite direction of that. Are those numbers that make sense to you?
Well, the numbers actually don't make sense, only in the sense that it's just beyond my imagining.
Of adding that much forest land?
Yeah. I mean, I just, it's a striking number. But to think about, to go back to one of your original questions, like, it's not just the political will. Do we have the budgets to do that? And just to focus in on the United States and to think about particularly California, but take the Forest Services, the U.S. Forest Services budget, roughly half of it is been basically is every year is sequestered for firefighting. Well, that means they're not doing the right work that the care that we've been talking about, Carrie, in terms of pre-fire action. And at the same time, you know, counties are greenlighting massive subdivisions in what Cal Fire describes as high intensity fire zones. So, you know, we can plant all the trees we want, but the political activism on the part of legislatures and their budgets, both national and state, are not going in the same direction as the kinds of things that we need.
Molly, why aren't political policymakers and legislators in your state of California feeling more heat, I guess, from this to make some of these changes? Is there so much pushback that it is easier to just, you know, do nothing and keep kicking this down the road?
I mean, I don't know that I that might have historically been a thing people said, but I, you know, well, here's an example. In the Cal Fire budget, suppressing fires was nearly $1 billion in the fiscal year 2018 to 2019. Mm-hmm. It was $900 million. So, you know, but the firefighting budget quadrupled in that time. So, you know, the amount we're spending on suppressing fires in a 10-year period increased by a factor of 10. The amount we're spending on Cal Fire overall increased by only a factor of 4. Which means that we're spending more and more of our state budget on suppressing fires. Why do we have to do that? Because we have homes and we have communities in harm's way. And we aren't requiring more of these communities because it's politically very much remains very much a third rail to ask them to stop, to put more requirements on them. With the campfire in Paradise, we saw that homes that were built to a 2008 standard, and communities that were designed to a newer standard, were safer against fire. But we haven't required communities built before that time to come up to that standard. We haven't provided communities with money for that. And we haven't asked communities to think about their relationship to fire in an organized fashion.
You know, Professor Miller, this reminds me a lot of flood policy. That, you know, people will continue to move into flood zones and communities are loath to say you can't build another housing development right there on the coast. But when something happens, it's very expensive. Federal taxpayers have to help pick up the tab. You see any way out of the kind of cycle that Molly's just described?
Yeah, there actually is. And the flood comparison is apt. In San Antonio, Texas, and subsequently in Houston after Hurricane Harvey, what both cities had begun to do, and San Antonio started in 99, is to buy up houses in the floodplain. The county was tired of doing exactly what you said, which is doing high water rescues that are dangerous for everybody.
Right.
And used local money. It did not go to the feds. It didn't go to the state. It used local money to start to buy up housing in the floodplains. Houston has launched a similar program for its marshland, where it had once allowed people to build anywhere. Now it's decided that's probably not a really good idea. Apply that then to fire zones. You could do this proactively, which is to buy up open land before it gets built. And in the foothills of Southern California, a lot of communities, including my own, have been doing that piece by piece. It's expensive, but I suspect it's a lot more expensive to try to get people out of fire and then to replace those houses than it is to purchase it. Or you do it retroactively after a fire. You go in and incentivize people not to rebuild by paying them market price for their property.
Yeah. You know, they've done that in flood zones in North Dakota. That's interesting.
Yeah, exactly. In the Red River.
All right. Call here from Dave in Minneapolis. Hi, Dave. Good to have you on the phone.
Hello. I should say first, I have a master's degree in forestry from the University of California, Berkeley, and worked in forestry for several years out in the late 70s. in Forest Service research. Then I have a PhD in forestry from the University of Minnesota and worked here for 34 years.
I'm glad you heard the show. Good.
So I wanted to make a comment about something one of the guests said earlier. You know, following a wildfire like recently occurred in the Sequoias, it's not a given that you're going to get forest subsequently. A lot depends on what kind of plants exist and seed sources exist and what the climate changes that have occurred in these last several decades and subsequent insect and disease infestations, sort of how all that plays out. And the real concern I see is that we're going to lose significant acreages of forest land, not only in California, but here in Minnesota and many other places, because of increasing lengthy droughts like you've experienced in recent decades in California, subsequent insect and disease infestations, movement of more southerly kinds of insects and diseases to more northern places. So I'd like the guests to comment on that in terms of concerns about losing forest land because of all these different stresses on the forest and urban development, exurban development, they call the rural-urban interface. You know, all those have adverse impacts on forests and our ability to retain the forests that we have, much less expand the forest area.
So, Dave, we'll do that. We're going to get a look at the latest news. When we come back, I'll ask Molly and Char Miller to reflect a bit on what you've said about, because you're right, we didn't even mention drought. I kind of alluded to insect infestations, and we'll talk about that as well. And then what do these forests look like, 40, 50 years into the kind of climate change that we're on the precipice of right now? Okay, continuing now with Molly Peterson. She's a science reporter for KQED, and Char Miller, professor and director of environmental analysis at Pomona College. Molly, I want to toss this drought question to you because I know you can't be a reporter in California without reporting on drought. Give us the intersection between the drought and the forests and forest management that our caller was asking about.
Well, I think your caller was asking about the kind of the long-term future for these forests in California as well, and obviously drought is part of the threat to them. Every time a fire threatens one of these forests, what we end up considering is, at the break, I was actually thinking about Big Basin, which is a redwood forest in south of the Silicon Valley in Northern California. Mm-hmm. And where redwoods are able to survive these increasingly intense fires there, the long-term prospects for these redwoods are diminishing because of the transformation that we're wreaking on our landscape and on our climate already. And a manifestation of that is drought. A manifestation of that is, you think about those redwood forests, south of the Bay Area in this kind of coastal, foggy landscape that is less foggy, whose soils are changing because the moisture in them is changing. And there are examples of this all over the state of California in different ways. Your caller also was correctly, I think, pointing out that, even when we talk about nature being able to heal itself, nature may be able to heal itself not back into a forest, but into this transformed landscape, not back into a shrubland, but into something slightly different.
Char Miller, what Molly just said reminded me that I wanted to ask you about whether there is something about these contemporary wildfires that they burn hotter, they burn more ferociously, that is a greater threat to trees? Or is it exactly what Molly was just saying? They're already in kind of a weakened position because of the other effects of climate change. Is it all of the above?
Yeah, it is all of the above. And Molly's absolutely right that for example, coastal fog has diminished considerably. Where I live, we used to get fog a lot coming off of the Pacific, and now it's a much greater rarity. And that does change. Fog and other factors does change whether when a seed, pine cone, say, drops onto the ground, whether it can actually root in that soil. And the estimate of Forest Service Ranger researchers in New Mexico and Arizona after the big fires earlier in this century there is that they can't. And that's how we start to calibrate the conversion process. What it converts into, you know, we'll see. But I think part of what we have to get comfortable with, and it's very uncomfortable to do this, is that sequoias, redwoods, and others will at some point not be there. And they are the things that are around which the state has sort of framed itself for so, so very long. And, you know, that's on us.
You think people will know, and I don't know how long, what do you think the timeline is when you say they won't be there? 70 years?
I mean, it depends on the forest and the place, but the guess is by the late 21st century, we're going to know.
Oh my gosh, wow. I mean, and as you've alluded to this, the identity of California, I wonder if people will know what they're missing.
I think they'll know it. Well, you know, that's also part of the problem is change and climate change is not something you can put your hand on. It's not palpable that way. You can't see it happening the way you can absolutely see a hurricane or a tornado. But at some point, you know, anybody in, I don't know, 2190 can read Muir and Mary Austin and others and go, holy mackerel, what have we done? But by then, it's way too late.
Yeah, Liz asks on Twitter, is the University of Minnesota or anyone else working to develop heat-tolerant varieties of paper birch and other native trees vulnerable to climate change? What trees should we be planting? Professor Miller, back to you on that. I don't know if you know what's happening at the U of M, but is there research on some of these heat-tolerant or resistant trees?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. And the Wood Products Lab, the Forest Service Lab up in Madison and elsewhere, they're doing exactly those kinds of things. And it's a really good question because let's say you have a fire in California or Northern Minnesota or wherever it may be. The instinct is to go back in and plant the things that have been growing there. I'm not sure that's the right call.
Yeah, why?
Because in 40 years, the climate may be such that whatever you planted there may not grow. And the Forest Service has had some very disastrous experiences in the Angeles National Forest, which wraps around where I live, sort of going in and planting stuff, and it all dies. It's like, wait, isn't that itself a signal that the climate has changed to such an extent already that we need to be thinking about new species that might be able to grow here? But it's so hard to wrap your head around the fact that the pine, the Coulter pine or something like that, that might have survived in another generation will not survive now. And that we have to be so forethoughtful as to think around a world that we'll never live to see.
Molly, what's the debate sound like over forest thinning? I know this is really controversial in other parts of the country.
Well, I mean, we've been talking, you know, I've been thinking about what Char is saying. We've been talking about how climate change and these large scale fires are, you know, creating things, conditions in our forests that aren't turned back. But I want to tell you a little story about last year, I spent some time up in Trinity County in the far northern part of California, and I talked to people who are there's this growing idea around, for even though what we're doing is not at scale, even though what we're doing, and in fact, in this story I'm about to tell you, meets its own frustrations. There are people who are trying to relate to the forest and understand that climate is changing, but also try to figure out a way to manage it responsibly locally. Mm. And what I saw in Trinity County was really interesting to me because it brought people together across longstanding tense political lines. In the far northern part of California, there have been historic fights among people who want to protect trees and people who want to log trees. And in Trinity County, you have people from both of those camps plus seven other camps who come together in these conversations around a community forest on federal and local land and say, how do we manage these forests in a way that makes some sense? And what they're trying to do is reduce the controversy that you're talking about. So the controversy comes around the, you know, particularly around cost. It comes around liability. So if a prescribed fire gets out of control, who pays for it? And it comes around other legal questions that involve, you know, laws that are the correct direction, the right intention to protect endangered species, and are, you know, a source of tension in and of themselves.
You know, Molly, in some ways, what you're describing sounds like the kind of de-escalation that is, you know, happening, I think, in some small areas across the rest of our political spectrum, right? There are people trying to de-escalate and de-demonize, right, the way that we have grown so accustomed to debating highly emotional and political issues. It sounds to me like that's some of what you might have observed.
I think that's right. And I think there's something to me, regardless of whether or not, as a reporter, I have to talk about when something is an insufficient solution, when a bill fails at the state level that would improve how we plan and think about communities that are pushing further into the forest. We see all these failures, but there's something inherently hopeful to me about when people look at the conditions where we are in a truthful way mm-hmm. and try to come to a solution together.
Yeah, Char, I wonder if you have a thought on that.
Yeah, actually, it's very interesting. I was talking yesterday to the Middle Leadership Program in Montana virtually, and that was sort of the point at which I closed my talk, which was that I think, let's call it the third wave of conservation in the United States, it may be a fourth wave, is framed around collaboration. And it requires a greater humility on the part of those who are engaged in this process, to be sure. But it also means casting a much wider net of stakeholders, of those who are involved in these discussions, starting first and foremost in California and elsewhere with indigenous peoples who have managed these lands for millennia and who have a pretty good oral history that tells them and shows them how these management decisions can be made, but also includes, as Molly said, all sorts of folks who have been clobbering one another for decades. Because if you can start to have a conversation, and maybe Cal Fire facilitates it, maybe the Forest Service facilitates it, they don't own the table, they facilitate the conversation.
Oh, right.
Then you can have a much broader community base. And I think Molly's absolutely right that some of this change is going to happen at smaller scales because people are more nimble at smaller scales. But you start knitting together these coalitions, these collaborations, and you can start to have pretty important changes. And the tribes in Northern California have been leading this charge, the Karuk in particular, that I think to me signals some really interesting issues and ways of going about it. The question isn't that it can happen, because it is. Mm-hmm. It's how quickly could we move that to a larger scale, to what Molly called these landscape level conversions have to be met at the landscape level.
Yeah. You know, I appreciate what you said also about the Forest Service doesn't own the table. They're facilitating this. And so people really feel like they can have influence on the policy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Brett called from Virginia, Minnesota to say, I live mostly outside. I grow as much food as I can. I'm building a cabin by hand. Impressive. It's essential that we have connections to nature. Judy called from Sortel to say, I have found a huge change in walking in the woods. All my life, my family's had a cabin. And now even in the later summer months, we have to dress covered because of the bugs and the deer ticks. It's getting worse. We do have a question here about other insects to Meredith in Minneapolis. Meredith, thanks so much for waiting.
You're welcome.
What bug are you thinking about?
Oh, the jumping worms. They're an invasive species from Asia that have just been decimating the soil in Wisconsin and arboretums, and we have them in our yard.
Really?
So I was just, yes, I was wondering if your guests could comment on that and other insects and invasive species.
Meredith, by the way, what do they look like? I'm wondering if I see them in my garden.
Oh.
And what are they, little small green things?
No,
okay.
they look similar to a regular worm. They have a band around their, I think it's called the clitellum, is white. And then they writhe around like snakes. You just touch them and they just whip around. And from what I've read, they're not really common knowledge yet, but they don't actually damage the trees or the plants. They turn the soil into really gritty, like coffee ground or kitty litter consistency. And then the plants, the roots erode or the dirt erodes, and then they're slowly damaging the top layer of the soil in forests, and all of that natural flora and fungi and things that are there are just going away.
Professor Miller,
hopefully I explained that. Okay.
No, you really did.
No,
yeah. Molly, you've heard of these jumping worms?
Well, I Char might know much more than me, but I worked briefly for a NASA-funded citizen science observation project where we saw reports of these from people who wrote into us. I know that these jumping worms are really kind of creepy. They really do writhe around like that.
Yeah.
And they've been. I know that Oregon. Has them as well. And I know they've been documented going back to the 1990s. So this is about how they interfere with the natural processes for bacteria and fungi in the forests that help break down the forest floor. Right. And I think this is probably where Char should take over.
Yeah, Char.
But they've been around and I've seen them and they're disgusting.
Never heard of them. So I'm really glad we got a call. Char?
Any worm that's a jumping worm scares the heck out of me.
Yeah, exactly. This is just against nature. Yes.
I know about as much as Molly, and I think she's got a much better feel for this, but I would say that the larger question of invasives, and Minnesota is, one of the hotbeds of zebra mussels.
Oh, yeah.
And so what we're going to see more of this, and that's partly driven by the global economy and the speed with which material moves around the globe. And so, it comes from in the whole, ballast in a hold for zebra mussels and with worms. I presume it's a horticultural thing that people are bringing in plants from other places and planting them. And all of a sudden you get free riders who say, Eureka, this is a whole new ecosystem we can take off into. We're seeing these kinds of things at a small level, that is to say a small insect or whatever, and to much larger animals as well. And I think we're going to have to get very comfortable with that, a way of thinking about it, and not in these particular cases of mussels and worms, but in other ways. What we call invasives may well be climate refugees.
Yeah. Hey, Char, are there organizations or an organization that you've seen doing work, really important work more at the ground level that we're a philanthropic community here that you would say you really want to make a difference on this, do some of the things we've talked about, but also support an organization like this? Does one come to mind?
Way too many come to mind. I mean, I think I would do it site specific. I would, for folks for whom the boundary waters are crucial, that's what I would support, because we really want to make sure that that place stays as it was intended to be. And there's a certain mining operation that you might want to oppose up there.
Uh-huh.
But I think part of the site specific thing is actually also how do I describe it? It's place based. It's an awareness that you live in a particular kind of community and a particular kind of ecosystem, and that's Minnesota is not California and vice versa, and it's not Texas and it's not Florida and it isn't Maine. And so I would pour my energy into the places that I know and love, and use that as a way to guide one's philanthropic efforts.
Really good advice. Boy, I learned so much. Char Miller, Molly Peterson, thank you. I know it's early out there. I am really grateful for the time this morning. Thank you both very much.
Thank you. It was fun.
Molly Peterson is a science reporter for KQED. Char Miller is a professor and director of environmental analysis at Pomona College. Both of them joining us this morning from California.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!